This week, I talked to Carlos from Ace Team, and this is an interview that I've wanted to do for so long. I've been a fan of these guys since Xenoclash back in 2009. You've probably played their game Rock of Ages. They've had so many other great games, and I recommend you check those all out, especially Deadly Towers of Monsters. Great game. They've got a new one coming up called The Eternal Cylinder, and this was just a great conversation with Carlos. I got to ask him questions that I've had for years since I've been following these guys so long. So check it out.
Your warning, if my kids interrupt the interview for whatever reason, this will end up being one of those, like the BBC video where the little girl came into the interview in the middle of the thing. But I'll just have to accept that because it's hard to control them. So
yeah, hey, no problem, man. We'll roll with it. Cool, okay. Man. Well, thanks for doing this. This is awesome. I'm a big fan of your guys' games, and I'm excited to talk to you about them. And I know you've had your own company, Ace Team, since about 2009, right?
Correct. It's actually goes a little bit back in the sense that we formed the company for this like predecessor of Xenoclash, which never took off, which was called Xenozoic. So we tried to start in the 2001, but the studio was more like a mod team where we had this programmer, the three brothers, and we were trying to get things to work out. But it was not that professional. It was more like just a group of guys trying to do the best we could and working on some total conversions and stuff. But we did form the company then in 2001, and it was kind of on hold for a while. And it really didn't start operating as a company until 2007, which was like 2 years, the 2 years that it took us to release Xenoclash 2009.
Okay. So you guys started out just doing like mods and total conversions. That was kind of your entry into video game design?
Definitely. I mean, 2001 is when we tried to get this... it was not really a mod at that point because we basically got this project called Xenozoic. Yeah. Is that we took contacted Lithtech, which was the engine provider for the No One Lives Forever 2 game. At that time Monolith was working with that engine provider, and we tried doing some work on this project with them. I'm talking about a time when we were getting SDKs by physically shipped CDs. So the internet wasn't what it is today. But even prior to that, we had already worked on a couple of total conversions, one being The Dark Conjunction, which was, I think, the only single player Quake 3 Arena total conversion that ever was made, which was like a short thing, 7 levels. It wasn't that polished, but it had its cool sort of Lovecraftian vibe. And even prior to that, in the late 1990s, we did a for Doom, classic Doom, we did a Batman total conversion where all 30 levels were changed for Gotham City, where we had like enemies of all sorts, and the bad guys from Batman, the Penguin, yeah. Joker.
Cool. How old were you when you were doing all this? I mean, Doom, that's back in the 90s.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, Doom is early 90s, and we were... this is talking about a time when it wasn't so common that everyone was on, like, the latest thing in terms of gaming, like, some people were like already way past Doom already. I think playing Quake 2, I think already was in, but we were sort of lingering there in time, like kind of stuck in this community called Doom World, where there was a lot of active members making mods. They would change levels, and we had our active participation back then. So it was like the late 1990s. I must have been my 15, 16, 17 years old, something like that.
Oh, okay. And you say we a lot, and you're referring to your two brothers.
Oh, yeah,
Andres.
I always talk about, it's something I have to clarify, and, mm-hmm. and we, that means mostly, at least at that point, obviously not now, we're a larger studio, is Ace comes from A-C-E, Andres, Carlos, Edmundo. It was just the three brothers goofing around, and we came up with it.
Wow. That's pretty awesome that you guys have like continued to stay together and to work together through all these years. That's pretty impressive.
Yeah. It's not very common.
Yeah. So let's start with Xenoclash, because that was your first big game, I feel, and that was a game I remember playing and just being kind of really taken aback by just the surreal environment and this weird story, and everyone's talking in, you know, this weird way, and there's these bizarre characters, and you know, it was just so out there, and it really caught my attention. That, on top of the melee combat, I thought was really good as well. But where did the idea for that even come from?
So it was a project that came from this other failed project, which I'm mentioning. So mm-hmm. we had a very we had a fascination with these sort of story book. Turn your, like, choose your own adventure, these kind of RPG books where you mm-hmm. like have these paragraphs that send you to, if you're going to choose this, go to this page, if you're going to choose this, go to this other page, and there are many different ones, and there was this series of one called Sorcery from Steve Jackson, which was illustrated by John Blanche. And at the time, we weren't that familiar with John Blanche's work, but he's a very well-known artist sort of worked for magazines like The White Dwarf and did some punk fantasy stuff at the time. And he had this very particular style that was very cool. Like, it was very not traditional in a sense that traditional fantasy where you have the orcs, the elves, the mm-hmm. wizards with the pointy hats. He was doing something pretty different, and it was so cool. This is from the 1980s, his work. And he's also a prominent illustrator for the Warhammer series. So, like, for teenager at that time, young adult, we found fascinating, like, all the style he brought into the stories that we were reading and these game books. So we really wanted to use that as a little bit the basis for this game that we were starting to develop. And this project, which I mentioned a little bit briefly earlier, is called Xenozoic, was this project working where we were working on the lithic Jupiter system. We tried to do a bunch of stuff. It was a kind of Xenoclash-ish game, but it was more, it didn't have a strong focus on the melee combat. You had alternate ways of solving certain problems, but we're still very inexperienced. We didn't manage to capture, like, we were like trying to do too many things, and mm-hmm. that ended up getting us to a point where we had something that looked pretty cool but didn't play all that well. It wasn't that impressive, and it's kind of reasonable that people who are learning the trade of like learning how to be a game developer were learning and doing that with mods and stuff. You had to sort of learn by failing, like by reaching certain points in which you look back at what you've done and see what worked out and what didn't work out. And so this project was something we worked on for a couple of years. We had a scouting agency. It was something that just doesn't exist anymore, but people that look at your work and try to see if they can sort of pitch it to a publisher and everything, they evaluated it, and eventually we came down to realizing that it wasn't going to work out, and we were not at the level of maturity where we could take this into another project. But what we did do is that we looked back at it and decided, okay, we did learn so much trying to do this project. So what were the best parts of it, and what were the parts that didn't do all that well? So what we decided to do is sort of focus on very few aspects instead of many aspects, and focus the game design on some very key elements and try to approach them like all our efforts will go into these a few things. So the surreal sort of art style, we decided to push it way further than what was in that prototype. You can actually find a short video of Xenozoic if you Google it in our YouTube channel, mm-hmm. and then you can compare it a little bit to how Xenoclash looks. So that was one of the areas where we said we definitely have to push more in terms of the style of the art and go a little bit more aggressive with this punk fantasy style and everything. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that the shooter aspect, we weren't making a great first-person shooter, but we had a sort of tried to see if we could do something melee combat, and there were very few games doing melee combat in first-person at that time. So we decided we would do our own thing, and the game sort of... For the game mechanics of the melee combat, we decided we would do a mix of... This is going to sound kind of crazy, but the NES classic Punch-Out.
Mike Tyson's Punch-Out. The really Punch old out. One. Yeah.
Mike Tyson Punch-Out with Zelda, where you have the locking mechanism, like you lock onto an enemy and you circle straight for a round because you have like this targeted enemy. Now, lock-on mechanics are super standard. It's been used by almost every prominent game. But at that time, there were not that many, and we were big fans of... we're pretty much Ninja Dorks for a very long time. So, yeah, that's where we got some ideas for this. Yeah,
very cool. That is I'll look that up later. I'm excited to check that out. Xeno's Zoic. And, you know, you mentioned like a combination of Mike Tyson's Punch-Out and Zelda, you know, two of these classic games. And I know in a lot of your games, I've kind of seen that come up a little bit, like Soul Seraph. I see a lot of ActRaiser in that, or Rock of Ages. I don't know if this is a reach, but it reminds me a little bit of Marble Madness in a way, just like that rolling physics. And then also in your new game coming up, Eternal Cylinder, I noticed that character looks very similar to Q-Bert. So do you draw a lot of inspiration from these older games you played as a kid?
Definitely. I mean, Q-Bert, you nailed it perfectly. Mm-hmm. The inspiration for the Trebum, which is the name for the little creatures, it comes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I've said it whenever I've been asked. It certainly comes from Q-Bert. So that sort of tells how old I am. I would say Soul Service is the most obvious one. Mm-hmm. I'm not very happy with how that project ended up for us, because I feel there's so much more that we wanted to do, and it came out being probably our weakest project, basically because... we didn't have enough time to really... It was a smaller project. I wish it could have mm-hmm. been something that we could have put more of the soul of the studio into. But yeah, you have your ups and downs, and that definitely we've had our projects that have... I would say that basically the more... The project where we worked more on our ideas... and being more we've taken the risk of going for unique sort of game mechanics and doing something that's really different has been where we found the most success. And the titles where we played it safer, being obviously Soul Seraph, the clear example, has been where we've done worse.
Yeah. And, you know, I think your biggest success might be Rock of Ages, right? I feel like that one's the one that if I were to poll people, Rock of Ages, I feel like a lot of people have played, and you've had a sequel to that, and you've got a third one coming up too. Rock of Ages 3 Make and Break coming out this year. And what's new in this new version of Rock of Ages?
Okay, so yeah, you are correct in saying that Rock of Ages is currently the one that's it's the most well known. Well, probably, if you poll people, it's the most that people will know. But definitely, the sort of fan base, the what we've Xenocash still remains as what the people sort of associate the studio with the most. Mm-hmm. That like, when is there going to be another three? Like, that's what we get requested the most.
Oh, really? Like, and, I mean, I hate to be that guy, but do you have any plans for Xenoclash 3?
It's always in the conversation. It's something that, I can't say no, and I can't say yes. It's we're being super tight-lipped about it because it's a big project. It would demand quite an effort from the studio, given the complexity of making a first-person game in these days, with the level of quality you would need to achieve. But it is an ongoing conversation that we do have a lot in the studio. But going back to Rock 3 and the question about what's new about that title, definitely the biggest aspect of Rock 3 is the level editor, like the sort of community aspect of the game, where we expect that a lot of people will have a lot of fun making their own maps and sort of goofing around with the tools and making their own tracks and playing around. It's a much more creative game in terms of allowing the players to sort of express themselves and do their wacky levels and play around. Yeah. But the game in itself still has the same structure than the previous ones, where there is a main campaign with a main character, totally bananas storyline where we follow these silly cinematics which show the hero advancing in these really absurd situations, some boss battles in the middle of this which are equally absurd. So yeah, I would say it has the cool components of Rock of Ages 1 and 2, plus this feature of having the level editor. And that also has allowed us to grow, like, make the... I think in terms of the campaign, where Rock of Ages 2 was fairly standard, where you would go into these sort of war matches, you could basically earn stars by playing each level on either obstacle course or war, which is the main game mode. And basically that we had all the maps sort of set up for these two scenarios, and you had to sort of advance that way. But the good thing is that having the level editor for us is a very powerful tool for us in terms of development. Because that allows us to create levels that much more quickly. So in Rock of Ages 3, the campaign has tailor-made levels for specific game modes. It's not like this one specific level that has to sort of adopt different game modes. So for instance, if you're going to do maybe an obstacle course level, you're going to be thinking more about how to do it as sort of a racetrack where you have obstacles and you might have these shortcuts, big long jumps and stuff like that, versus if you're going to focus your progression in terms of progression, the level is going to be a war match. You have more the strategy elements. So the level design can be more interestingly made for the different game modes. We have new game modes. We have a Humpty Dumpty new game mode where you instead of a boulder, you're playing with Humpty Dumpty, and you have to sort of evade all these obstacles and avoid getting the egg destroyed. So I think the campaign in that sense is is even much more interesting. We have more levels, and they're more tailor made for those experiences. So I think it's a pretty interesting project.
Yeah, and that level editor, so that's going to be available even on the console versions of these games, right?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Awesome, man. I look forward to it. When's that coming out? Is that summer, or do you guys have a release date, or just sometime this year?
The release date I think it's June. I'm not the project manager, so if you've noticed, it's Andres, one of my brothers, so I have to go check. But just to clarify, Rock of Ages 3 is a co-production between Ace Team and Giant Monkey Robot. Chilean studio. It's another Chilean studio. You know, there's no way we could do The Eternal Cylinder and Rock of Ages 3 mm-hmm. both with our current team size. It's just, I mean, just dealing with both projects.
Yeah.
Even though we're working with another studio has been a little bit wild, to say the least.
Two games coming out this year. That's a lot for a small studio.
Yeah, it is. It's been pretty crazy, but the guys from Giant Monkey Robot have been excellent. They're really, they're really cool guys. They're people who we've known over the years in game development in different situations. When we were working in another studio, we met some of these people, and we were colleagues. And actually, Juan Pablo Lastra, the project lead from Rock of Ages 3 on the side of Giant Monkey Robot, he was originally at the very beginning a member of Ace Team. So it's people very close, and I don't think we could have done it unless it was a really like close relationship with another studio.
Yeah, that sounds like a good partnership. So when you're talking about your company Ace Team, what responsibilities do you have there? How do you split up the responsibilities between you and your brothers? Are you in charge of certain things?
We, the three of us, have different, like, in any indie studio, you end up doing a lot more than what you would do maybe working in a AAA studio, where the roles are very more strict and defined to certain tasks. Like, if you're a producer, you're a producer.
Yeah.
And maybe you're not going to be putting your hands into either code or design or, I don't know, changing, much less maybe altering particles and stuff. So, for instance, me and Andres, we work as producers and designers primarily, which doesn't mean that no one else in the studio has things to help out in those areas. Production, not so much, but design is something that we're constantly working out with Andres and El Mundo, and we sort of give feedback to each other, and we sort of make decisions on specific areas of the game, and one person might be more closely the lead designer of a project, but one of the brothers might have a much more stronger understanding of much more close aspect of designing the game on a certain aspect of it.
Mm-hmm.
So from maybe it might be the AI or creature behaviors. It can be different aspects. So, for instance, the Eternal Cylinder is definitely the project I'm more in charge of as a producer and designer. It did come. The project was born from a prototype that I did on my spare time with a colleague, a programmer, Leo Benalucci. So together we worked on this on our free time, and we came up with this almost like tech demo where we had the little funny creature, the Trebellum, running around in this sort of open world environment where the cylinder was moving around and crushing stuff, and we had one of the enemies, and it really was kind of a controlled environment, but it managed to be impressive enough that it caught the attention of certain people, and we never expected it to take off the way it did and transform into kind of the massive project it did. But yeah, that's going back to the original question. We take sort of turns depending on the projects and what our roles are, which is I find it very gratifying in a sense of not getting stuck doing maybe the same thing all the time. Even though you're working on massively different projects, sometimes just simply assuming different roles can be so interesting in a sense of having different challenges. For instance, in Abyss Odyssey, I was one of the people who did most animations for combat animations for it, because I have more years of working as an animator than the other two brothers. But Andres, for instance, has way more experience than I or Edmundo on particles, so he's usually the guy that does a lot of particle animations and effects. Edmundo is by far the person who knows more shaders and how to do a lot of stuff with in terms of shaders and effects and like with materials. He like knows that like better than any like outside of programming. He's like the technical art director. Like he knows that part really well. So we do have our areas in which we sort of specialize a little bit better than the others, but we like sort of working on many different aspects of the game, and it's very refreshing to sort of jump from one project to another, from being the producer to then not being the producer and maybe being one of the persons working on more level design or animation or other stuff.
Yeah, and you mentioned working on a lot of different projects. I'm looking at the games you guys have made, and there's such a wide variety of genres here. Why do you like to work in all these different genres rather than sticking to a specific one?
I think that's been kind of a double-edged sword in a sense that it's beneficial from the point of view that it keeps people way more interested in because you're tackling everything is new. Like each project is like such an interesting challenge on its own, where you jumped from doing a sort of Art Nouveau fighting game mixed dungeon crawler thing. And then you're going to do a game which is about old cinema with a whole Flash Gordon vibe, and it's more of a top-down RPG. So you basically, you can't take anything from the previous project and move it on to the new one. And that's really exciting. That really motivates the team in terms of how we approach projects. Now, the downside is definitely that if you work on one genre and you iterate on that genre and keep up perfecting all your upcoming titles, you'll end up being a super expert on developing this type of game. And that gives you, from my point of view, maybe if you do that very successfully with one title and you're able to sort of keep on doing that for sequels, it might be a path to success that is more focused or might give better results to the majority of studios than our approach, where you're sort of doing something completely different every single time. But I think that's one of our strengths, that our studio is well known for sort of being this very creative studio that does very unique and different things. And you wouldn't really wouldn't be truthful to that if you were always making the same game. So we do have our sequels. I mean, definitely Rock of Ages is reaching its third installment, and that does allow you to take a lot of what you had and just work on top of it. But the Eternal Cylinder was something that nothing we could rescue from for that project from others.
Now, you guys do have some sequels, but I notice you don't have any DLC for your games. Are you guys just not interested in DLC, or you're just done with the game once you've shipped it and you're moving on to the next?
We've tried always doing additional content, but we give it away for free. Okay. And we usually tie the free content to sales. I find that much more, at least for a small studio, if you're not selling copies, you always know that the DLC is going to be only bought, it will be bought by a subset of your players. So, yeah, if you're selling 10 million copies of your game, you might, and you have copies, I can understand a big publisher is going to want to charge for new content, because even if a 2%, 5% of your play, your install base buys that DLC, you're still talking about big numbers. Mm-hmm. Indie studios, even the ones that do well, don't reach those numbers. And I find it better to sort of keep the community engaged and to coming back to your title and having people recommend it, by just giving away the extra content for free and tying that to either a Steam sale or a promotion of some sort. It's also, I think, also better for the community, in the sense that everyone gets the content. For instance, Rock of Ages 2 did not launch with the Ski Boulder mode and a lot of other things. I don't remember exactly right now what other things we changed over time, but those we gave them for free. And I think it's the best way to go. From even from a business point of view, I think for indie studios, DLC doesn't seem like so reasonable.
Oh, okay. And I wanted to go back to Xenoclash for a moment, because I think that is the only game where you guys use the Source engine, and all your other games use the Unreal engine. Did you use the Source engine initially because that was just very easy with modding and you had kind of had that background, and then Unreal, the Unreal engine was better for you later? Or what was the reason behind that?
So it's kind of a little bit of what happened in the times that we were working on these different engines. So you are correct when you say that the Source engine was something we picked up because it was very friendly for modding, and there had been some pretty successful mods that had used it for their projects. At that time, Unreal Engine, the way it exists now, did not exist. So we really didn't get into Unreal until Epic launched UDK, which was the community, like the open version of Unreal. And after they did that, and Unity and Epic started sort of fighting for this, like being the lead engine provider of the industry, everything changed. Prior to that, getting sort of your hands on an engine, documentation, getting, like, doing stuff was way more complicated. I mean, game development was much, much, much harder. At that time, just because of the access you had to the tools, to the information, and what things you can modify about an engine were limited. So the Unreal Engine came out at a time when we were thinking about doing Rock of Ages, and the Source Engine was an excellent engine to work on Xenoclash, but because it was a first-person game, Half-Life is like first-person game, so we're basically doing pretty significant modifications, but we weren't like totally doing something that you had never seen another Source engine game do, which is Rock of Ages. So as soon as UDK came out, we said it seems quite more reasonable as a starting point for experimenting with this new idea. So we decided to work on the prototype for Rock of Ages, and well, the rest is history. Like, we ended up working on that project and it went out really well.
Okay. And you had referenced a game a little while ago, but we didn't mention the title of it, The Deadly Tower of Monsters. And you described it, or you used Flash Gordon-esque to describe it. And I really love that game, just the narration in it. And I'm a big film nerd too, so that game was right up my alley. Did that game kind of come out of a love of cinema? Was there any relation at all to Ed Wood or Plan 9 from Outer Space? I don't know if you're familiar with those films.
But... Yes, I am. Okay. We actually, you can even see it. What's the name of this? I'm trying to remember. Lost my line of thought. I'll get it back in a while. But yeah, so originally the Deadly Tower of Monsters. We had the whole idea for what the design of the game, like from a gameplay's point of view, was going to be, from a mechanics point of view, and what we wanted to achieve in the sort of dungeon crawler genre. We wanted to see what we could do in that genre and how we could innovate in it. Even though eventually the Deadly Tower of Monsters ended up being more like an action, not so much an RPG game, The starting point was looking at games that were traditional dungeon crawlers, top-down camera, you just move around and explore this sort of flat environment where you move from one room to another and sort of explore that way. And we wanted to do something totally opposite by adding verticality to the design. Mm-hmm. So at the starting point was this concept of having this huge tower and moving upwards, but the project was designed around this more. It didn't have the style of that the Deadly Tower has. It was more traditional sci-fi adventure sort of aesthetics. We were like playing around with what we could do in that sense, and we felt we had something pretty creative from the point of view of the design, but when we were looking at the art that we were producing, like on the concepts, we felt like it wasn't something so unique. Like doing a sort of adventure sort of game, which was going to be, I don't know, a fiction of some sort with not necessarily orcs and goblins and dragons, but it was around those lines, was not going to be something special. And we started goofing around with what else we could do from a visual style. And this was an idea that came on by mixing the like looking back at Planet of the Apes, Flash Gordon, many of these old movies, and how we could maybe mix those things to produce this kind of absurd plot where we had this space hero travel to this distant planet, and it would give it like a really unique style. And we were very lucky that in Atlas, the vice president was a fan of Flash Gordon and those types of movies, so it got greenlit much faster after we decided to choose this visual style for the project. We were good Godzilla dorks as children, so we did get like a lot of inspiration from the classics. But even for my age, a lot of the references from within the game are even older than me. I'm now 41, so that means I'm more like from the Star Wars and moving forward. So Flash Gordon is really not something that was commonly seen when I was a kid. So we did have to do some research and look into these movies. But it was really, really fun.
Awesome. Yeah, I really enjoyed that game. I definitely want to talk about the Eternal Cylinder. That's your new game coming up, and I'm really excited just looking at the screenshots and the videos of this. You know, it looks like it's kind of returning to that surreal world almost you had in Xenoclash, like that kind of style. And it's kind of hard to depict what's actually happening in it. So could you explain to me, like, just in your own words, what is this game? What's it about?
Okay, so the game, this definitely beats Xenoclash as our weirdest game easily, like no questions about it. But I think that's one of the strengths. I mean, I don't want to make people think that the game is like so out there that it's it's one of the most interesting aspects of it. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of a survival game, but whenever I present it that way, I tend to be very careful because it's a very unique approach to how we're doing. It's more of an adventure survival game with a strong narrative and like this universe where there is a plot. There is a beginning, there is an end, there is mysteries in the world, and these things are not usually related to survival games. And there are strong survival aspects within the game, and one of the key aspects of the game is surviving the cylinder, which is crushing everything and moving forward. So it's a survival game in that sense, that you have aspects about you, the little creatures, which you have to take into account. Like they need to be fed, they need to find food, they need to find water, they need to be careful with predators, they need to do all these sorts of things to keep them like safe from danger. And the other aspect being the obvious one, this massive cylinder which is crushing the entire world, which you need a sort of like escape. However, it's not like this only open world game where you sort of just progress and sort of build your little group of trebums and sort of get new family members and explore in a way that doesn't have like a goal. At the beginning of the game might be a little like, I don't know where I am, and it's mysterious and you don't really know what's going on, but we do build on a narrative, and one of the things you might find interesting is that the game has a narrator in the style of the Deadly Tower of Monsters, but in this case, very different. Obviously, this is like a comedy, like the Deadly Tower of Monsters, but there is a narrator that we use the same element of having someone who is talking over what's going on, because it's quite a bizarre alien world. So the narrator is helping us to sort of tie in things and give player direction and objectives. So I gave this huge long answer to a question that most games would have to say, no, this is a first-person shooter with multiplayer elements. And no, this is a long answer because it is a different game. And I think the cool aspect about the Eternal Cylinder, and what I think a lot of people will enjoy about it, is that it's a game like designed a little bit as if other video games didn't exist. It's like going back to the time when video games, something new would appear and you couldn't really classify it. Like that was something I feel was so cool about the 8-bit era, even before, where games were just like these games. It's not like we packed them into these very standard, this is a first-person shooter, this is an RPG, this is a racing game, this is a sim, this is a, like, and all those games in general that are within those groups are tend to be restricted to some very common game design aspects. They change in the form of how the art is or the game mechanics, but most people just start playing them and they know what they're mm-hmm. playing. It's not much of a surprise. I would say that the Eternal Cylinder is just simply not a game I can put anywhere. People have compared it with Spore, but it has nothing to do with Spore. People mm-hmm. have compared it with Pikmin, but it also doesn't have much to do with Pikmin in many ways. So it's its own thing. And why Spore and Pikmin? Because the tribe of the creatures, they a huge part of the game is that what they eat in the world gives them mutations, and they change and they grow longer legs, which allow them to jump, or a trunk that works like a horn, which makes noise and can scare off certain predators and do different things. So, like, the exploration aspect of the game changes a lot when you add these elements. So it's its own thing, but it's a game. If I had to summarize it and sort of leave sort of the aspect of trying to explain the game design, it's a game about family and adventure, where you have these little creatures who are born into this world. They are born right in the middle of a cataclysm, and they don't know what's happening, but they get to learn about their origins. They get to learn about what's happening, and they have this adventure to experience together, to find other of their brothers and sisters. So it has that, like, sort of cute aspect of having these little creatures form this family and this bond together, where they go through this adventure.
Awesome. Yeah, I look forward to that. I think what I really like about all your games is they really do bend the definitions of gaming genres, and there's always something very satisfying about them, the mechanic, and it's like you're always trying something new, and it's always something different. And as many games as I've played over the years, yeah, the one thing I always look for is innovation, something new. You know, give me something that I haven't seen before, and this definitely excites me. What, this is coming out this year, but do you guys have a specific release date yet?
We do, but if we fail it, and I say...
Don't want to hold you to anything.
No. My producer, I hope he can hear that. No, we won't fail it, but there's nothing to announce it. We're on track, and I'm confident that we will achieve our goals. And but going back to the question about the aspect about doing games that are very different to other games, it is something that, being completely honest, it is a huge challenge, because it makes your life so much more difficult. Because, for instance, the Eternal Cylinder is a game that you have to have a very fine line between innovating all the time and creating things that is new, and getting to the point where people just simply don't understand what's going on, and then you have situations where people can get frustrated mm-hmm. because people have gotten used to, over the years, to understand almost everything instantly and to have very clear expectations of what they're playing. So you do have to sort of address that segment of the players who maybe don't have the patience to maybe explore a little bit more and dive deeper into the mechanics. And that is super difficult when you're kind of making a game that's its own thing. For instance, I personally haven't played yet Kojima's last game, but that project had a huge challenge trying to tell people what the game was, even at the moment of release. It was not pretty clear, and I haven't played it, and still I'm not even really sure what that game is. And I'm sure it's fascinating and very interesting, and I look forward to playing it eventually when I have some spare mm-hmm. time. But it's projects like those that I think a certain segment of players like really like appreciate. Like you go into Death Stranding and what is this? It's something that's definitely not the standard game, and certainly there are people who you look into the reviews and say this boring walking simulator, and those people you never change their minds. Maybe they wanted a Metal Gear game or something which was more akin to other of the games that were done by him. Mm-hmm. But I think that for the industry to truly progress and reach areas where maybe we're not exploring, I think game developers, it's cool to see people, and especially a project of such high production values, do something so extreme.
Yeah, I wholeheartedly agree. I think the most interesting games are just being made at that indie level where all those risks are being taken. You know, as we wrap up here, I always like to end just by asking people, as a game developer, what kind of games do you enjoy playing yourself these days?
I haven't played that many games from the recent one. I just recently beat Doom Eternal, but I had to just because I'm a massive Doom dork. Mm-hmm. So I played the first ones like forever and like for such a long time, and I skipped Doom 2016. Shame on me. So I felt I had to play the new one, which is obviously really great.
Oh yeah.
But you'll find it a little bit maybe unusual that I tend to play a lot of sort of traditional AAA games because I feel I sometimes get ideas from things that I feel maybe they could have done differently. So, for instance, I really, really, really love the God of War, the new one, like the latest one. And looking at that game, you look at it, and obviously it's a more standard game than Death Stranding. It's an action fighting game, but they did take some risk, big risks, changing mm-hmm. the formula. And looking at those things is very interesting. Bloodborne, I also enjoyed very much.
Okay.
PlayStation 4. And I've recently been playing more on my PlayStation than on my PC. Not necessarily because I think I don't want to get into the whole console versus PC thing, mm-hmm. but because the PC you're just so used to as a game developer opening the tools and everything. It's sort of the environment where you have the PC tends to be more focused to work. So my PC is usually in the place where I work more. So when you grab the console, you just sort of like, you know, you're more.
You got to separate the work and the play. No, I see. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I also beat Red Dead Redemption 2. I didn't play the first one. I really enjoyed that game also.
Oh, cool.
So yeah, maybe a bit boring answer because they're very fairly standard games.
Yeah. Well, believe it or not, that is the most common answer I get, is a lot of people just play the AAA stuff. I totally get it. There are some great games out there. Well, Carlos, this has been awesome. I mean, ever since we started doing these interviews for our PC gaming podcast, like Ace Team has been up there on my list to interview because I've just enjoyed your games throughout the years. I've brought them up constantly on the podcast, and I still encourage people to go back and play Xenoclash, even though it's a little older now and, you know, it's not as fresh now, but I still think that's such a great game, and I just always look forward to whatever you guys are doing.
Awesome. Thank you. Well, thank you very much for recommending your audience to our studio.